Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our IQ window forecast tonight is going to be 57 degrees and clear. Imagine that. 57 degrees. Wow. And the humidity is finally dropping, which makes it really, really a decent early fall here in North Carolina. We like it. This is where the past meets the future. You're in the right place. In here, the results are mostly always positive. We try to talk about positive things here. Whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, I guarantee you're going to find out something you did not know. The solar wind tonight is a brisk 410 kilometers per second, and there are 7 sunspot clusters on the sun today. The proton count is up to 3.1 per cubic centimeter. That means you'll want to wear at least sunscreen SP4 when you go outside. The NOAA forecasters estimate a 75% chance of polar geomagnetic storms tonight in response to an expected CME impact. High latitude sky watchers, you people up there in British Columbia, should be alert for auroras. We've got a dynamite show for you tonight. Actually, we don't call it a show, we call it a program. It's one of the nice things about X Squared Radio. Is we don't do this for entertainment purposes only. We do this to awaken. We do this to arouse your faculties, to get you thinking, to get you questioning, to make you realize who you are, why you're here, what you may become. The thought that you are a sovereign being frightens those who think they're in power. So, let's get into it. By the way, don't forget our phone lines are going to be open all night. Toll-free North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. And we've got a bonus for you tonight. We have new equipment on the conference line. So if you want to call, and just listen, put it on your cell phone as a speed dial. You can pop in anytime you like. It's 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. Then put in the passcode 769-608-POUND, 769-608-POUND. And you will be highly informed while walking around with your Bluetooth hanging from your ear. Very nice stuff, very nice stuff. Welcome to the program. And you can call me anytime tonight, or you can reach me on Skype at X2-Radio. Lots of people send me little instant messages during the program, and I will, if you want me to acknowledge, I will say who sent it and what your question is, and we'll answer it. And there aren't too many subjects that we can't handle, so send it to me, especially if you found something really interesting local that no one's talking about. We'll address it. Don't forget the book Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty. It is actually the precursor to the Liberty Amendments, which is Mark Levin's new book. He also has 9 amendments. I have 3 amendments that we do away with and 6 that we pass. And I don't know if they're similar or not. I haven't read Mark's book. I think the world of Mark, I think he's a great attorney. I think he has a little bit more acidic personality than is my liking, but he gets his point across. The point is that when Alienated Nation came out in July of 2012, it absolutely rocked the headlines. It went to number 1 on Amazon in 2 different areas of political science, and It sets the challenge for those 40 governors that have passed their sovereignty acts to get their act together and get this constitutional convention underway. It is the only way that we can recover the republic from the agency government that has seized control and now rules our nation. All those agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations that write all those regulations that Congress has no idea what to do with. And you can see that almost on a daily basis if you go to C-SPAN, or it should happen to make the mainstream news. You can see the agencies basically fanning their chin, you know, the way the Three Stooges used to do it. Fanning their chins at Congress saying, come and get me, coppers. I'm going to send you all the evidence you want on black paper. See if you can read it, idiots. Congress is absolutely powerless. Oh, they can hold you in contempt of Congress. Big deal. Fan the chin and go on. There's nothing you can do to stop me. That's exactly what the way the agencies feel. The GSA, the IRS, the EPA, they're all doing it. Why? Well, because it's the agency government. Hundreds of thousands of bureaucrats. They're not elected. They're not appointed. They're not approved. They're untouchable. And they write thousands and thousands of regulations every single month that you must comply with. They tax you, they fine you, they confiscate your property, and they forbid you from liberty. And you have no representation in that government. That, my friends, is taxation without representation, which is the definition of tyranny. We are in it, live and in person. And there's nothing anyone can do about it except for those 40 governors that have passed those sovereignty acts. You know who you are. You know who they are. I'm asking you to go to Amazon.com, buy the book, Alienated Nation, and send them a copy. If you want to buy it from my website, alienatednation.com, you can do so. There are some bonuses for doing that. A, you get the book autographed. B, you get the entire book in audio for free. I just give it to you. So if you're not a good reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. And then when you get those books in, I suggest you buy two. Several of you have in the last week or two. Send one of them to one of your governor's campaign offices. I promise you he will get the book. If enough of you send the books, he will get the book, and it will change the world. Okay, let's get started. The claim came as the Obama administration, with the assistance of Senators John McCain from Arizona and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. By the way, both senators may face formidable challenges in 2014. And the open involvement of the number two man at the U.S. State Department made a concerted effort to see Muslim Brotherhood leaders in Egypt released. Oh, yes, it's true. Regardless of what you're hearing in the mainstream media as statements from the administration, it is absolutely true. In an interview with the news agency Anatolia in Turkey, Saad al-Shatir, the son of imprisoned Muslim Brotherhood leader Karat al-Shatir, said his father had in his hand evidence that will put Obama in prison. That's right. In a thinly veiled threat, that means, see what I got in my hand here? It's thinly veiled threat. Saad al-Shatir said a U.S. delegation was sent to Cairo by Obama to press for the release of the imprisoned Muslim Brotherhood leaders, including his father, to prevent the release of explosive information. You know, when people are in jail, sometimes they want to make a deal. to get out of jail, because life is no good in jail. There are things you can't get in jail. Arabic-speaking former PLO member Walid Shoabat has translated the report by the Turkish news agency Anatolia as follows. You might want to just cinch up that seatbelt just a little bit. This is going to be a little bit rocky. Here we go. Let's see here. In an interview with the Anatolian news agency, Saad al-Shater, the son of a Muslim Brotherhood leader, the detained Kairat al-Shater, said that his father had in his hand evidence that will land the head of the United States of America, President Obama, in prison. He stressed that the senior U.S. delegation currently visiting Egypt knows full well that the fate, future interests, and reputation of their country is in the hands of his father, and they know that he owns the information, documents, and recordings that incriminate and would condemn their country. Such documents, he says, were placed in the hands of people who were entrusted inside and outside Egypt, and that the release of his father is the only way for them to prevent a great catastrophe. He stated that a warning was sent threatening to show how the U.S. administration was directly connected. The evidence was sent through intermediaries, which caused them to change their attitude and correct their position, and that they have taken serious steps to prove good faith. Saad also said that his father's safety is more important to the Americans than is the safety of Mohamed Morsi. Writing in his blog, Shoabat noted that six different Arabic sources confirmed the interview with Saad al-Shater and the report of al-Shater's claims. Shoabat said the interview with Saad al-Shater was August 7th. That was just 18 days ago, making it likely the reference to the senior U.S. delegation currently visiting Egypt was about the trip by McCain, Graham, and U.S. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns. On August 6th, the day before, with interim Egyptian Vice President Mohamed El Baradei, the former general director of the UN International Atomic Energy Agency, McCain and Graham, called Kairat al-Shater and other jailed Muslim Brotherhood leaders political prisoners. They told reporters in Cairo that failing to release Muslim Brotherhood prisoners would be a huge mistake. Egypt's interim president, Adli Mansour, rebuffed the U.S. delegation's request, telling reporters in Cairo that it constituted an unacceptable interference in internal politics, and rightly so. On August 6th, the Associated Press reported the Egyptian government planned to prosecute Kairat al-Shater and the other imprisoned Muslim Brotherhood leaders on charges of inciting violence last December when Muslim Brotherhood members attacked sit-in protesters outside then-President Mohamed Morsi's office, resulting in the deaths of 10 people. ABC News reported that Burns traveled separately late Sunday night, August 4th, to the notorious Torah prison in the middle of Cairo to meet with Kairat al-Shater, despite claims by the Muslim Brotherhood that al-Shater refused to meet. In an August 6th interview with CNN in Egypt, McCain mentioned jailed Kairat al-Shater, an openly acknowledged Muslim Brotherhood leader, when asked about individuals who could successfully negotiate a future Egyptian government. Former U.S. Attorney Joseph DeGenova, legal representative for Benghazi whistleblower Mark Thompson, claimed this week that intelligence officers with knowledge of the attack on Benghazi consulate believe it was tied to 400 surface-to-air missiles intended for Syrian rebels that U.S. officials feared could be used to shoot down an airliner or attack a U.S. embassy. This vindicates exactly the story that was broken right here on X Squared Radio by me. You'll recall, if you listen to the archives, I was the one that put together The Benghazi brokerage of these Libyan missiles, rockets, and grenades to Turkey by Ambassador Stevens. Stevens knew about it. It was a loose end. He was maybe not so trustworthy. He was compromised. And so they allowed him to be killed. And I just found out tonight that it was, in fact, allegedly Valerie Jarrett who gave the order for the military to stand down and let Ambassador Stevens be murdered. 2 weeks after the Benghazi attack, WorldNet Daily was the first to report sources claiming the Benghazi compound was an intelligence and planning center the CIA used to recruit and arm Islamic rebels to fight Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Well, that was 2 weeks. 2 days after the Benghazi attack, we did it right here on X Squared Radio. Interesting stuff, huh? You're starting to see. Maybe you should listen a little more often to X Squared Radio. Hold on. Orange juice. Glorious weather now here in the southeast, by the way. It was a good day for golf. What? 90. Okay, I haven't golfed in a while. 90. Not so bad. All right, there's a story out. It came out 2 days ago. And the title of the story is actually, "Did you get the memo? Be afraid, America." We don't often see articles like this in the press here in the United States. But the taglines, this is a Breitbart story. The taglines are martial law, United States, NSA spying, police state tyranny, blah, blah, blah. You know, those kinds of taglines. Now, sadly, and probably expectedly, we have grown accustomed to the tyranny at the federal level. It is... been feared and suspected for hundreds of years, literally. States have complained about it. Statesmen have complained about it. It is the reason why the United States was formed in the first place, was the tyranny at the royal level in colonial America. And since there were only 13 states, that word, tyranny, has often been used by states when describing a very powerful central government. It is inevitable that when a central government becomes also the central bank and the central law enforcement agency, etc., etc., that tyranny has a way of creeping in. The CIA, which is the most efficient organized criminal operation on the planet. The spy tactics of the NSA would make the East German Stasi green with envy. With the NSA watching our every move, nobody should feel safe for fear of being branded an enemy of the state. The TSA processes hundreds of thousands of Americans every day into the secured areas of our nation's airports, and we file through for searches and seizures like no generation of Americans in history. No problem. For our own good and safety, every airport in every country. Even journalists are feeling the brunt of the newfound bravado of the globalists. The systematic murders of journalists such as Andrew Breitbart and Michael Hastings for getting too close are stark reminders that our republic democracy is a facade and has degenerated into a wolf in sheep's clothing. The rule of law has become the rule of the executive and his cabinet, the king and his court. Talking about the Council of Foreign Relations used to bring on the tinfoil hat comments. Now this criminal organization and its anti-liberty minions are fully exposed as evidenced by Hillary giving her Secretary of State farewell address to the organization on January 31st, 2013, as she ended the most scandal-ridden tenure for a Secretary of State in national history. Council of Foreign Relations, CFR. Oh, yeah, it has an acronym now. It's on the wall. Just go look it up. Hillary Clinton, farewell speech, CFR. You'll see it right there on the wall behind her. Council of Foreign Relations. That's where the real State Department is. Well, here's an excerpt you might find interesting from that speech. It was a long speech. It had the usual fluff in it, but there was some disturbing things in it. I'd like to quote them for you so that you'll understand what this administration is about, what the coming administration is about. What?
What are you saying over there?
The coming administration. Come on. I saw the bumper sticker the other day. It says Hillary Clinton, Michelle Obama, 2016. Yeah, it's red, white, and blue. It's a red, white, and blue bumper sticker. On the top, it says Hillary Clinton. On the bottom, it says Michelle Obama, 2016. They can't lose. All right. Okay. We'll discuss it later. All right. This is the speech. I'm not going to read the whole speech, but you need to understand this. This is a quote. To understand what we have been trying to do these last 4 years, it's helpful to start with some history. Last year, and I'm speaking as though I'm Hillary Clinton, I'm quoting her speech. Last year, I was honored to deliver the Forrestal Lecture at the Naval Academy, named for our first Secretary of Defense after World War II. In 1946, James Forrestal noted in his diary that the Soviets believed that the post-war world should be shaped by a handful of major powers acting alone. But, he went on, the American point of view is that all nations professing a desire for peace and democracy should participate. And what ended up happening in the years since is something in between. The United States and our allies succeeded in constructing a broad international architecture of institutions and alliances, chiefly the UN, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and NATO. And I'm just going to throw in parenthetically, each one of these organizations have a long and terrible history as the most corrupt national manipulators in world history. You'll remember just recently the IMF closed the bank in Cyprus, stole hundreds of millions of dollars of depositors' money. Not the bank's money. Not the bank's money. The depositors' money. Just took it out of their savings accounts in order to balance the books of the bank. Of course, a few very well-placed depositors were allowed to get into the bank early and get their money out. The World Bank, look it up for yourself. You can look it up anywhere you like. Look it up in Ripoff Report. Google it. You can read for days the corruption in the World Bank and manipulation. And NATO goes without saying. We've already invaded and destroyed several sovereign nations in the last two decades with no declaration of war. Let me continue. The IMF, World Bank, and NATO that protected our interests, defended universal values, and benefited peoples and nations around the world. Yet it is undeniable that a handful of major powers did end up controlling those institutions, setting norms and shaping international affairs. Now, Two decades after the end of the Cold War, we face a different world. More countries than ever have a voice in global debates. We see more paths to power opening up as nations gain influence through the strength of their economies rather than their militaries. And political and technological changes are empowering non-state actors, like activists, corporations, and terrorist networks. At the same time, we face challenges from financial contagion to climate change to human and wildlife trafficking that spill across borders and defy unilateral solutions. As President Obama has said, the old post-war architecture is crumbling under the weight of new threats. So the geometry of global power has become more distributed and diffused as the challenges we faced have become more complex and cross-cutting. So the question we ask ourselves every day is, what does this mean for America? And then we go on to say, how can we advance our own interests and also uphold a just, rules-based international order? A system that does provide clear rules of the road for everything, from intellectual property rights to freedom of navigation to fair labor standards. Simply put, we have to be smart about how we use our power, not because we have less of it. Indeed, the might of our military, the size of our economy, the influence of our diplomacy, and the creative energy of our people remain unrivaled. No, it's because as the world has changed, so too have the levers of power that can most effectively shape international affairs. I've come to think of it like this. Truman and Acheson were building the Parthenon with classical geometry and clear lines. The pillars were a handful of big institutions and alliances dominated by major powers. And the structure delivered unprecedented peace and prosperity. But time takes its toll, even on the greatest edifice. And we do need a new architecture for this new world. More Frank Gehry than formal Greek. Think of it. Now, some of his work at first might appear haphazard, but in fact it's highly intentional and sophisticated. Where once a few strong columns could hold up the weight of the world, today we need a dynamic mix of materials and structures. Now, of course, American military and economic strength will remain the foundation of our global leadership. As we saw from the intervention to stop a massacre in Libya to the raid that brought bin Laden to justice, there will always be times when it is necessary and just to use force. Now, I'm not going to read the entire speech, but there's another section in this speech, almost as long as this one, and it goes like this. And we're also using economic tools to address strategic challenges. For example, in Afghanistan, because along with the security transition and the political transition, we are supporting an economic transition that boosts the private sector and increases regional economic integration. I want to throw in parenthetically before I read this next sentence that Afghanistan's primary economy is heroin. And although it is true that our troops, National Guard and professional army, are guarding those poppy fields and supervising and perhaps even escorting the convoys of raw material to the processing plants. We have seen an inflow of raw heroin into the United States that is unprecedented. The Taliban have become the greatest and most successful and most feared drug lords the world has ever known. Heroin is making its way into your neighborhood in more refined forms, in more marketable forms. And we're seeing people every single day in rehabs, not just rock stars, not just actors, middle schoolers, high school kids, hooked on heroin. We never saw that before. We have heroin coming into the United States. Why? Because we buy it. Because we have the money. It's also doing the same thing in Europe. It's also doing the same thing all across the Middle East. Two wars were fought over opium to keep it out of China, and China lost those wars against Britain as Britain tried to inebriate the entire nation of China so that it would not have to face it on the open sea. And it worked. Let me continue. It's a vision of transit and trade connections we call the New Silk Road. A related lever of power is development, and we are helping developing countries grow their economies not just through traditional assistance, but also through greater trade and investment, partnerships with the private sector, better governance, and more participation from women. We think this is an investment in our own economic future, and I love saying this because people are always quite surprised to hear it. 7 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa. Other countries are doing everything they can to help their companies win contracts and invest in emerging markets. Let me also throw in parenthetically that at one time, in one place, 3 former presidents and the current president were all rendezvoused in Africa. That's right. Former President Bush, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, and Barack Obama all met in Africa. Bet you didn't hear that on the news, did you? Other countries still are engaged in a very clear and relentless economic diplomacy. We should too, and increasingly we are. And make no mistake, there is a crucial strategic dimension to this development work as well. Weak states represent some of our most significant threats. We have an interest in strengthening them and building more capable partners that can tackle their own security problems at home and in their neighborhoods. And economics will always play a role in that. Next, think about energy and climate change. Managing the world's energy supplies in a way that minimizes conflict and supports economic growth while protecting the future of our planet is one of the greatest challenges of our time. So we are using both high-level international diplomacy and grassroots partnerships to curb carbon emissions and other causes of climate change. We've created a new bureau at the State Department focused on energy diplomacy, as well as new partnerships like the U.S. European Union Energy Council. We've worked intensively with the Iraqis to support their energy sector because it is critical not only to their economy but their stability as well. And we've significantly intensified our efforts to resolve energy disputes from the South China Sea to the Eastern Mediterranean to keep the world's energy markets stable. The key word here is stable. Nothing to upset the apple cart. No disruptive energy technologies. Nothing to take those nations off the grid. Everybody gets on the grid. Everybody pays. Everybody's happy. Stable. Stable. A critical strategic dimension to this development work. Got it? And that's all I'm going to read from Hillary Clinton's speech. Does it sound globalist to you? Does globalism sound good to you in some way? My phone number is 888-429-5471, and I would be happy, I would be overjoyed to speak about it with you, to listen to your comments. Where the federal government and the existence of their Confederate secret societies, such as the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, were once denied, they are now fully admitted and championed as the true rulers of this country. And the NSA is now outed as gathering conversational data on each of us, you and me, all of us. So that in case you decide to run for office or should happen to make a public statement against the government, it can be used against you to discredit you. And there's more. In a recent Reuters report, the tip of the iceberg came up out of the rough seas just a little bit more. Are you ready for this? I know you've heard part of it. Hold on. Let me get another sip of my lovely orange juice here. Hold on. You see, one of the marvelous things is that we also live in an age of many thousands of aware people. Some of them have blogs. Some of them have cell phones. Some of them have talk radio programs that go out uncensored around the world 24 hours a day. Anyone can access it. Anyone can listen. The BBS radio network is one of the largest free radio networks on the planet. More mainstream data flows out of the BBS radio network than anywhere else. Anywhere. You're here. You're at the headwaters. The U.S. National Security Agency has now been found out. It's been suspected for a long time. It has bugged the United Nations, the New York headquarters. Germany's Der Spiegel weekly said on Sunday, that's today, in a report on U.S. spying that could further strain relations between Washington and its allies. You know, those nations that we're strategically working with. You heard it. Hillary's speech, I just read it. Citing secret U.S. documents obtained by fugitive former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who we have now officially nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, Edward Snowden. You'll recall last year we nominated Julian Assange for the Nobel Peace Prize. Because neither one of these individuals did any of the stuff that they revealed. Sure, they were secret documents. Of course they're secret documents, just like you keep your secret texts secret. It's your communication. But they're the ones that committed the crimes. Okay? These documents revealed people were murdered. People were spied upon. Of course that's bad to release out to the public. Who wants to have that found out? But if you don't want it found out, don't do it, you see. That's why Edward Snowden is now nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, because he aired the dirty laundry. Well, Der Spiegel in the file showed how the United States systematically spied on other states and other institutions. Not just you, not just me, also the big guys. And it's remarkable because those guys, those institutions, they spend billions to keep themselves secret. Billions. They don't like to be surveilled like this. They know they are, but my goodness, now it's out. Der Spiegel. It's like WorldNet Daily. Der Spiegel said the European Union and the UN's Vienna-based nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, were among those targeted by U.S. intelligence agents. Wonder why. Let's see if Tony has some input. Tony from Alberta, Canada. Welcome to the program.
Brooks, you were a friend of Kevin Smith, right?
Oh, absolutely.
He passed away on August 17th.
The Kevin Smith?
Yes, the Kevin Smith Show, yes. I thought I would call you and let you know that, because I know you were a friend. You were on his program quite often.
Yeah, we just talked last week.
He had a heart attack.
Another
one? And he had a heart attack, and there was complications, and he passed away.
Wow.
We're all in shock.
Oh, my gosh. Kevin Smith was my mentor in this business. I mean, Don at BBS Radio got me started, but gave me the confidence to keep going was Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
What a great guy. He was having such a blast, too, with his new band.
I know. He had a good program, you know, and I thought, well, you know, because I remember I've talked to you before, and I remember you were being on Kevin Smith's show, and I was in George. So I thought, well, I want to give you a call and let you know. You may not know.
What a loss. What a loss. But he was doing what he loved doing, and I had the greatest respect for Kevin Smith. Wow.
Well, he worked so hard. You know, he only slept like 4 hours a day, eh? And he was always short on funds, too, eh? It was always a tough row for him, eh? And he got attacked so often, they always wanted to shut him down. You know, I guess some of the subjects they got onto were they didn't want anybody to know about him.
Well, he had a broad reach, no question about it. Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, the biological transducer gives out after a while, and some of the things that we do as a lifestyle, smoking and not taking care of our bodies, eventually they're going to give out. And we just try to do what we love doing, and we love life. And I can tell you, I know this for a fact, Kevin is not finished.
Well, some of them, you know, I think. Did you know Jerry Wills?
No, I didn't.
Because he was the co-host, eh? And I think he might take over the show.
Interesting. Well, I hope he does. It was a good format, and it was a good platform, a good thing to go on. Yeah. But you know, I'm not sad because Kevin was my friend, a longtime friend, many years. And
was that right? Eh, long time. Eh.
And he was doing what he loved doing. And
he was getting into music. You know, I didn't realize what a kind of professional musician he was.
Yeah, he's a good writer, and they just got a big music contract.
Things are really starting to pick up for him.
He was loving life, and that's good. That's exactly what we should do right up to the last minute. That's what every one of us should be doing. Kevin.
He was doing a great. But I just thought I'd let you know, because you know, I don't know too much about what's happening in the States, and I don't understand what's really happening there, because I'm a Canadian, of course, and it just seems to be a mess. What's going on there, you know?
Yeah, I
don't know. I don't know who's running the government there. You know?
Well,
the shadow. You know, they always talk about, like, I know Kevin used to talk about a shadow government. You know, and so I don't know if that's true or not.
It is. It's a group of agencies in Washington. They've been there for 80 years, and now they've come into their own, and now they run the country. They actually are trying to run the world, and we'll see how it works out.
Yeah. So, anyways, I just thought I'd, you know, pass this on to you.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you very much. Welcome. Thanks for calling.
I'll call you some other time when you were talking about something that I know something about.
Well, I hope you find this interesting anyway.
Well, I do. I listen to your show every Sunday. So.
Well, I really appreciate you.
You know, because you have a good show. And you're a good host.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, you have a good night.
All right. Thanks, Tony. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, Kevin Smith of the KevinSmithShow.com. One of the absolute great pioneers and great leaders in webcast radio out there in literally every country on the planet, and slugged it out on his own, went up against sometimes terrible odds. People would just hack his site and try to take it down, and he was on numerous lists because of the information that he covered on his program. Great friend. Really appreciated his just talking on the phone and being on his program, and he was on my program, wrote a book called Gods in the Garden. Just multi-talented, brilliant man. He will be missed in mortality and remembered forever. Thank you, Kevin Smith. All right, so in the summer of 2012, NSA experts succeeded in getting into the UN video conferencing systems and cracking its coding system, according to one of the documents by Der Spiegel. The data traffic gives us internal video teleconferences of the United Nations. Der Spiegel quoted one document as saying, adding that within 3 weeks, the number of decoded communications rose from 12. This is now 3 weeks from 12 decoded communications to 458. I would say that that was a successful hack. Internal files also show the NSA, that's the National Security Agency. Yeah, the National Security Agency. Go figure. They spied on the European Union legation in New York after it moved to new rooms in autumn of 2012. Among the documents copied by Snowden from NSA computers are plans of the EU mission, its IT infrastructure and servers. According to the documents, the NSA runs a bugging program in more than 80 embassies and consulates worldwide called the Special Collections Service. The surveillance is intensive and well-organized and has little or nothing to do with warding off terrorists, wrote Der Spiegel. My goodness. Well, here is an open letter. How long is this? It's not too long. I'm going to read it for you. It's an open letter. Snowden's leaks have embarrassed the United States by exposing the global extent of its surveillance programs. Washington has said its spies operate within the law and that the leaks have damaged national security. Not their activities. The leaks have damaged national security. A week ago, Britain, a staunch U.S. ally in the intelligence field, detained the partner of a Brazil-based journalist working for London's Guardian newspaper who has led coverage of Snowden's leaks. You recall reading about this in the press, of course. British police said documents seized from David Miranda were highly sensitive and could put lives at risk if disclosed. The Guardian last week destroyed computer equipment containing Snowden files after it was threatened with possible legal action by senior British government advisors. In an open letter to British Prime Minister David Cameron, published on Sunday, last Sunday, editors of leading Nordic newspapers said Miranda's detention and moves against The Guardian were undermining the position of the free press throughout the world, and they are. We are deeply concerned that a stout defender of democracy and free debate such as the United Kingdom uses the anti-terror legislation in order to legalize what amounts to harassment of both the paper and individuals associated with it, said the letter from Sweden's Dagens Nyheter, Finland's Helsingin Sanomat, Denmark's Politiken, and Norway's Aftenposten. Earlier this month, U.S. President Barack Obama announced plans to limit U.S. government surveillance programs, saying the United States could and should be more transparent. Pardon me while I laugh. Ha 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 ha. The issue has also become a hot topic in Germany before an election next month. Some reports have suggested that German intelligence agencies have actually cooperated with the U.S. spies. And there could be voter backlash if it emerges that Chancellor Angela Merkel, tipped to win a third term, knew more about such cooperation than she has so far acknowledged. Well, isn't that the way of it, though? Don't we do Watergate every election? Don't we find out all the dirt on our opponents? And either we leak it to the press or we go to them and we say, if you don't drop out of this race or accept a position in my cabinet, we're going to leak this to the press. Now, you don't want that to happen, do you? Sound familiar? Sounds like the theme of way too many TV shows. We see it all the time. And we're seeing it again. And it breaks my heart to see that this Roman method of diplomacy is what we are using now. This mafia-style government. I really, I don't know what to make of it. I don't know how to stop it. I don't think there is a way to stop it unless we do this constitutional convention. Then there's a way to stop it. Then there's a way to end it. Because we empower the Supreme Court to uphold law that allows Congress to take the agency government apart, brick by brick, and put it back under the control of Congress and stop the fanning of the chin as they come before Congress and say, come and get me, coppers. Such terrible things, terrible things. Real quick story before we round out the hour. No, it's not that quick because it leads into what we're going to cover this next hour is how can we trust the NOAA? Because it seems that the data that we're getting isn't as clear and clean as we once thought. And also the NOAA is tied into the reporting of the pollution that is belching out of Fukushima. Now, this is not smoke. This isn't ash. This is highly radioactive waste that's being carried around the world, both with ocean currents and atmospheric currents, hence the integration of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration data, because it has closed 600 out of nearly 9,000 weather stations over the past 2 years that it has deemed problematic or unnecessary after a long campaign by one critic highlighting the problem of using unreliable data. Oh, it gets better, way better. And you need to be aware of it, especially if you're thinking about moving to the west coast of the United States or to Daido Cho. Daido Cho is south of Fukushima. It's where I used to work in Japan. You drive a little bit north to Fukushima along the coast, and I have actually visited that reactor when it was in operation, and I was quite impressed with it, even though the locals told me that it was doubtful that it would hold up under all of the tectonic activity that was rumored to have occurred a lot in that area. I never experienced a major earthquake when I was in Japan, but they happen all the time. And this is not all the way as far north as Tokyo, but it's, you know, it's the northeastern side of Japan within eyesight of Mount Fuji. So give you an idea where it's at. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll play a little Muse, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 59 degrees and clear. That's what we like to see. That's getting to the more beautiful motorcycle riding weather. I'm so happy that you could join us tonight. And if you're out there listening live, you may want to voice your opinion on some of this, or at least share your thoughts. By the way, my condolences go out to Kevin Smith's friends and his family and his audience. He will be sorely missed in mortality, but I can promise you this. I know Kevin. He's not finished. He's out there. His influence is out there. His voice is out there forever, and his influence will be felt for many, many years to come. Kevin made a difference. Thank you, my friend, Kevin Smith. You want to be part of the program, it's 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere else, on planet or off planet. If you can get to that cell phone tower, you can get to us. 530-413-9537. And the conference line is bigger and better than ever. The sound quality is superb. 805-399-1000. 805-399-1000. Then dial the passcode 769-608-POUND. 769-608-POUND. You'll enjoy it out there listening live to X Squared Radio. And the beginning of this hour, I just want to let you know how important it is to love one another, to always look for the good in one another every single day and help it to grow. The incessant energy that seems to be out there to argue, to find fault, to find weakness in others. I would implore you as mortals to resist that temptation. Even if you don't trust people, don't violate their privacy. Take care to love one another. And don't be afraid to love. Because even if it doesn't work out, the love is so magnificent. It's so awesome. That feeling, that wonderful feeling of bonding and melting into each other, that is the true core of the human experience. It isn't the fighting, it isn't the wars, it isn't the winning and the losing, it isn't the wealth, it's the love. Now, speaking to one of my superhero friends over the weekend, I can tell you that the superheroes are gathering all around the world, and you know who you are. You have special talents that no one else can match, or if they can, it would be a struggle. Each of you have your talents. Each of you have your special thing that you came here with, that you are developing and that you can develop. The time for the superheroes is coming. Because the crumbling of the establishment of this network that I read to you about in Hillary's speech in the last hour, it is beginning to crumble. It is beginning to crack. It is beginning to become infected with a terrible fungus that is eating away at the joints of it. It will age them, and they will fracture. And they will fall apart. And when it does, it will be time for you, you superheroes, to step forward and to hold up your part of the world. I don't mean go to war. That's not what I'm saying. The time is coming for the end of wars. How do I know that? Because I know, and you know, who is behind all those wars. And those men and women are about to lose their power. They're about to lose their franchise on what it means to be mortal on planet Earth. The Earth is getting ready to have an allergic reaction. You can already feel it, can't you? You know I'm speaking the truth. And although there will be masses lost, because some people just have to have a handout, they just don't know how to grow their own beans, they don't know how to filter their own water, they don't know how, and we can't take care of everyone at one time. And it's a terrible, terrible state that governments have brought their people to. They have made them so dependent upon them that they cannot vote for anyone else. The republic has been destroyed. Free elections, gone. Liberty, forget about it. Democracy, non-existent. Why? Because they own you. They own your food. They own your water. They own your electricity. They own your education. And where once we may have thought we could have climbed out of the slavery that man inflicts upon itself generation after generation, those days are gone, for we are enslaved. And the next freedom, the next opportunity to walk away from the plantation is coming. And unfortunately, not many will make it. And it saddens my heart to see the planet have to go through this. But it is brought to us by the evil that has lived on this planet since it began. And mankind must reject that evil. We must love one another, or we're not going to make it. The next generation of mortals may make it. All right, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has closed 600 out of nearly 9,000 weather stations over the past 2 years. They say they're not really necessary. The data is not really helping us. The question remains as to why they continue to use a polluted mix of well-sited and poorly sited stations. This is a script from a Fox News report. They continue to use these poorly sited stations, and they're really in bad repair. I mean, you see a meter on the wall, and that's about it. Watts has for years searched for weather stations that have flaws, and he points to a still open station at Yosemite Park as an example of one with heat sinks, objects that store heat and then release it at night. The heat sinks can cause stations located in or near them to give off useless data, generally in the form of inflated temperatures and not representative of the broader area. If the heat sinks are a road, a building, a stacked metal pipe, beams surrounding the station, it can throw you off. After the heat sinks were added at Yosemite, temperature readings show a curious trend. Minimum nighttime temperatures increased more than daytime temperatures. Watts says that's because the concrete structures store heat that is released at night, and that such a trend backs up the idea that the heat sinks are having an effect. You shouldn't have them. But the government agency that compiles the temperature data says that such concerns are unfounded because of statistical methods used to adjust the data. We call it sampling, or we call it bias. We call it a fudge factor. There is no doubt that NOAA's temperature record is scientifically sound and reliable. That's Scott Mullen with the NOAA. He's a spokesman. To ensure accuracy of that record, scientists use peer-reviewed methods to account for all potential inaccuracies in the temperature readings, such as changes in station location, instrumentation, and replacement of urban heat effects. Smullen added that the recent station closures, which were made after an extensive six-month review by all National Weather Service forecast offices, make the system even better. Well, some of the first official notice of Watts' findings were in the leaked ClimateGate emails from 2009, in which the director of the National Climatic Data Center at the NOAA appeared to take Watt's findings seriously. Quote, he has a website of 40 of the USHCN weather stations showing less than ideal exposure. He claims that he can show urban biases and exposure biases. We are writing a response for our public affairs and not sure how it will play out. That was Thomas Carl, the director, wrote in an email. Then the Government Accountability Office, you know them as the GAO, the government agency which issues reports evaluating other agencies, they looked into the issue of inappropriately cited stations, interviewing Watts two times. In August 2011, a report titled NOAA Can Improve Management of the U.S. Historical Climatology Network, the GAO concluded that NOAA has not developed an agency-wide policy. Weather stations that do not adhere to sitting standards should remain open. Watt says this isn't good enough. It is shown a 1.1 degree Fahrenheit increase over the years 1979 to 2008. That is noticeably lower than the government estimate of 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit, which includes readings from all stations, including those with potential problems, which it tries to adjust for, statistically speaking, using those fudge factors I was telling you about. So the NOAA has its problems. Watt says, I don't dispute the satellite measurements, but they are measuring temperature of the atmosphere above the Earth, and that includes all cities and populated areas as well as rural open space. My premise is this, he says. If you want to see the effect of CO2 on warming, you need to look in areas that have not been affected by urbanization to find the true signal, you know, the baseline. In other words, Watts says the data show that global warming is due relatively more to increased urbanization than to greenhouse gases. Such a finding would be relevant for whether government should further restrict greenhouse gases. Questions should then be asked about decisions all the way up the food chain. Now, that story is significant. Excuse me while I take a sip of my orange juice. It's significant because these same stations, although they also measure temperature, they also take air samples. They measure moisture, dew points. They measure the gas chemistry, you know, the CO2, the carbon monoxide, chlorofluorocarbons, those kinds of things. They send up weather balloons and they gather samples at different altitudes and they report that. One of those pieces of data now is the amount of radiation in that air. That's how we track it. You can go online, you can look at the maps, and you can say, oh, I live in a safe zone, or, you know, it's only 100 times, you know, background, which is still normal, and, you know, all of that. That, I can tell you, is not accurate. Now, the precision may be there, but the difference between precision and accuracy is important to know. For instance, let's suppose that you are an archer and you're shooting at a bullseye, and you have incredibly good grouping. That is to say, all the arrows that you've fired are very close to one another. That's called precision. Precision. That means that you can hit the same mark over and over and over again with precision. Now, whether that group is on the bullseye or not, that's accuracy. So although the equipment may be precise, that is to say, it can measure to several significant figures, like 0.000, you know what I'm saying, significant figures, it may not be accurate. And that is critical, because the accuracy is what determines whether we're really in trouble or not. And I can tell you with some authority, because my degree has a concentration in nuclear chemistry, that you can be exposed to what's called acute exposure. That is to say, a fairly high dose for a very short period of time, Like when you go get an x-ray for your bones or your teeth or your mouth. You don't get an x-ray every month. You get an x-ray every 2 to 5 years. And so what happens is the x-ray excites or sputters off photons, generates photons in your body. And after that acute exposure, it has a half-life that's very short, tails off and it's gone. Your body recovers from it. But a chronic exposure can be of lesser intensity, but repeated over and over and over again. It's sort of like spanking that rash, you know? When you spank the rash, it really gets sore. And that's what happens, because we're talking about statistics here. We're talking about probabilities here. We call it incidence of collision. DNA, genes, the genetic material that makes up the human body, are rather large molecules. They're complex proteins put together with amino acids. Now, with an acute exposure, mostly it's water in the body that picks up those, whether it's a high-energy neutron or an X-ray or a gamma ray, and then it decays at a later time, and that's what causes the damage to the body. But a chronic exposure raises the significance of collision with genetic material in the body, and that collision causes mutations. This is where leukemia comes from. This is where tumors come from, because the genetic material, the unfolding and refolding of those complex proteins, becomes full of errors, and the errors get duplicated, and it makes a difference in the nucleus of that cell. It changes the look of it. If you look at it under a microscope, you see a normal cell has, you know, a normal cell wall. It has a normal nucleus. It has normal genetic material. You can stain the cell so that the genetic material shows up and that the nucleus shows up this nice, pretty blue or pretty red. And it has what we call a uniform morphology. That is to say, the nucleus is nice and round and sits there in the cell, just like it's supposed to. But sometimes we look at the cells and the nucleus is quite deformed. We call it a stab or an abnormal cell. And you get some of those. You have them, depending on whether you're fighting an infection or not, or eating well or under stress, those kinds of things. But what happens is the red cells become damaged to the point where the white cells think of them as an invader. And the white cells then bloom, that is to say, they divide uncontrollably and they go after the red cells and eat them. And what happens is you don't have enough cells then to carry oxygen throughout your body, and you get very tired and you die. That's leukemia. And that's why we do what's called a marrow transplant, where we take marrow from a suitable donor and we take the marrow out of your bones. We put that marrow in, and now you get new genetic material making new blood cells that don't have the cancerous effect in it. And the leukemia can sometimes be cured with a bone marrow transplant. It's radical. It is often successful. It is sometimes not successful. One thing is for sure, if leukemia is not treated soon enough, it is almost always fatal. You don't heal yourself from leukemia, not very often. And it is this chronic exposure to radiation that is and has the tightest cause and effect when we talk about leukemia and we talk about other cancers. Close to, high metabolism organs like the liver, the kidneys, the brain, those kinds of things. So when you're in the path of this radiation that's coming from Fukushima, and we're basically talking about cesium-137, but now it has been revealed that other species, even plutonium, was present in some of those reactors. No, they were not breeder reactors. I know what those look like, and that wasn't them. You've got to have centrifuges to accelerate the neutrons to breed those things. That was being done in Japan, but not there. It's being done south of there quite a ways. Fukushima was a power station, not a breeder reactor. They use the radioactive decay to boil water. They use the water to turn turbines as steam, and the turbines turn generators, and that's how they make electricity. I know. It's a little old-fashioned, kind of like a fancy steam engine, but that's what it is. And so you can get a little bit of radiation in the loop, but it is diluted, and it's handled very well with the heavy water, and it's not a bad system. And the cesium reactor, this was a bead-type reactor, not a chunk reactor, meaning that it had like little cesium ball bearings, and that's what it was using as its fuel. The rods are made up of bunches of these beads, and then you use lead to control the amount of neutrons that interact with the water and generate the heat. And that's how it happens. It's a nice system when everything, all the checks and balances are there. But when you have an earthquake and a tsunami, the checks and balances go away, and the reaction continues to go until it splits the water, generates hydrogen gas. The hydrogen gas floats above the reactor. Either it reaches the right temperature or some electric spark ignites that hydrogen, and the hydrogen recombines with the oxygen inside the containment, and boom. Now, that being said, that 15 feet of reinforced concrete is designed to hold that hydrogen explosion. It went even full of oxygen and hydrogen. It won't blow up. It takes something more. It takes a bomb to blow through that much concrete, and that's exactly what happened. Now, what to do about it? And that is really on a lot of people's minds right now, including mine. I don't really have any suggestions other than what they're about to try, but I can tell you that it is dangerous. Attempting to remove the fuel rods from a crippled building could cause unprecedented disasters. Okay? This could threaten to trigger a new and possibly more devastating nuclear disaster than the original or ongoing one at the Fukushima plant in Japan. It's on the east coast of Japan, which if you just stand on the beach and look far enough, obviously you can't, but you'll see the coast of California or the coast of Oregon or Washington. There's nothing between that plant and the west coast of California, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, but water. And the giant atmospheric river, which is monitored by the NOAA, which is why these two stories tie together. It's a risky plan, but ultimately it must be done. The fuel rods must be removed from these reactors and taken somewhere safe, like another reactor that's fully functioning. Or you've got to rebuild Fukushima into a fully functioning facility, not necessarily generating power, but with the ability to shut down that reaction and control the temperatures and run it as a shutdown reactor. We'd have to run it for 1,000 years that way, but that's what you have. And I can tell you both are very hazardous, because if you take the workers and the suppliers and the contractors in there to try to rebuild Fukushima, they're all going to die. There is nothing you can wear for that kind of chronic exposure up close and personal. You will die. According to reports by Reuters, the radioactive material within the fuel rods slated for removal are equivalent to 14,000 times the amount released in the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, and the plan to remove them has never been attempted before on this scale. Never been done. Yes, we can take out one fuel rod. That's been done, of course, when the rest of the reactor is fully functional and it's shut down. It can be done. And you'll recall that the first time this was tried, Fermi and Einstein had the nuclear pile, and what they did is they used a rope and block and tackle, And what they did is they manually used the block and tackle. It's a series of pulleys to make it where you can pick up the lead. And they pulled on the rope hand over hand, and they pulled the lead rod out of the pile, and they tied it off to the handrail. Their emergency system was an axe to cut the rope if things went wrong. Drop the rod back into the pile. Because obviously going hand over hand would be a slow process, a few inches with each hand over hand to get that rod back in. But if you really want to drop it quick and shut down that reactor, then you cut the rope with an axe and let the lead fall back into the pile and shut the reaction down. Because the lead is very dense and it absorbs the neutrons and slows down the reaction. Because otherwise the neutrons begin to cause a chain reaction. That is to say, instead of the neutrons running into the water, heating up the water to, you know, to turn to steam and all that, it runs into itself and it starts to create a chain reaction, which can result in a meltdown. Fortunately, it was successful. They didn't have to use the axe. They pulled the rod out. They saw the temperature go up, and it was exactly as predicted. And then they used the block and tackle to lower the lead rod back down in and shut off the reaction, shut down the reaction. But removing the fuel rods is a completely different thing because it has to be completely encased in lead. And it is heavy, extremely heavy, tons and tons heavy. It's difficult to move. Once the fuel rods are in place, they can be removed one at a time. The fuel rods are normally stored in a cooling pond. But if the reaction begins, then there is little doubt that they will have the ability to respond. And that's the danger. There's a risk of an inadvertent criticality if the bundles are distorted and get too close to one another because they'll start throwing neutrons into each other. The problem with a fuel pool criticality is that you cannot stop it. There aren't any control rods to control it, okay? There's no lead rods. The spent fuel pool cooling system is designed only to remove decay heat, not the heat from the ongoing nuclear reaction. Reuters also quoted from a recent independent report which stated a full release from Unit 4, spent fuel pool, without any containment or control, could cause by far the most serious radiological disaster to date. The site's operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, by the way, this was a General Electric reactor, and has been mired in crisis ever since the earthquake and tsunami in 2011. Most recently, it was discovered that as much as 300 tons of highly radioactive water has been pouring into the Pacific Ocean on a daily basis from the plant, with no promising remedy offered by either the plant's owner, TEPCO, or the Japanese government. 300 tons of radioactive water is flowing into the Pacific Ocean. This is why the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is involved, because they're tracking these ocean currents. Let me take one more sip here. Why are the ocean currents important? Not just if you're out there sailing, but if you're eating the fish that swim in those currents, if you happen to be a whale or a shark or a tuna or albacore and you're swimming in that water, you're being exposed to that chronic radiation. It is being infused into the flesh of that generation of animal. That generation of animal is going to give birth to other generations of animals, and those animals are going to be netted, and they're going to be processed and canned and fed to other animals, namely human beings. And over time, if you live on a diet of fish, Japan, Washington, Oregon, Western California, you live on a diet of fish, you are going to accumulate that radiation from that water. So when we read in Revelations that a third of the sea life dies, this may be how it's done, because fish get leukemia too. So that's why that's important. We're going to give you updates from time to time. I don't really know what's going to be done, but it has to be done. The fuel rods have to be removed. Somebody is going to have to design. Okay, I can do it. I can do it. Somebody's going to have to design a fuel rod transport system that can keep the fuel rods isolated and quiet while they're being transported. What we do with them, we can throw them deep into a salt mine somewhere 5 miles down in the earth, and we'll never hear from it again. It'll be fine down there. Or we can transfer it to another reactor and use it as a source of fuel. But it has to be done. It cannot stay in that reactor. You cannot have 300 tons of radioactive water going into the Pacific Ocean. The half-life on this stuff is between 125 years and 12,500 years. That's a long half-life. If it's allowed to continue, I know the solution is dilution. That's the normal way of taking care of a spill. Dilute it. And goodness knows we have enough ocean to dilute it. But it is not being dispersed. Okay? It's staying in these ocean currents like an oceanic river. And it's concentrating that amount of radioactive water. And that water is being exposed to wildlife, sea life, and it is going to have its effect. It's only been 2 years. In 20 years, you're going to see leukemia cases on the West Coast go up by 100 times. All right. I want to get back to this because it's important. We spent about a half an hour on this, and now I want to get back to this NSA thing. There is a new story out that says that the NSA is in control of the internet. So I'm just asking you to watch your step. Be careful what you send from your computer, what you put into your emails, even the stories that you grab and proliferate on your Facebook. Be careful. It turns out that the NSA's domestic and worldwide surveillance apparatus is even more extensive than we thought. Bluntly, the government has commandeered the internet. I never wanted to say that. I thought it was the last bastion of free press, and it probably is. Most of the largest internet companies provide information to the NSA, betraying their users. Some, as we've learned, fight, but they lose. Others cooperate. Well, we have one word of advice to all of you, whether you're an online broadcaster, a blogger, a writer, or an activist. Keep up the fight. You remember those old spy movies when the higher-ups in the government decide that the mission is more important than the spy's life? That's going to be the same way with you. You might think that your friendly relationship with the government means that they're going to protect you, but they're not going to. The NSA doesn't care about you or your customers, and it will burn you the moment it's convenient to do so. The only way that we can stop it is all of us fight. They cannot control everyone. And we're already starting to see that. Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, others, they are pleading with the government to allow them to explain details of what information they provided in response to NSA letters and other government demands. They have already lost the trust of their customers. Google probably, first of all, and explaining what they do and don't do. It's how to get the trust back. The government won't let them. They don't care about Google, they don't care about Yahoo, they don't care about Microsoft, and they don't care about you. There are lots more high-tech companies who have cooperated with the government Most of those companies' names are somewhere in the thousands of documents that Edward Snowden took with him. And sooner or later, they will be released to the public. And then you'll know. Then you'll know. The NSA probably told you that your cooperation would forever remain secret. But they are sloppy. They'll put your company name on presentations delivered to thousands of people, government employees, contractors, probably even foreign nationals. If Snowden doesn't have a copy, the next whistleblower will. I can guarantee you that. This is why you have to fight. When it becomes public that the NSA has been hovering and gathering all of your user communications and personal files, what's going to save you in the eyes of those users is whether or not you fought. Fighting, it might cost you money in the short term, but capitulating will cost you more in the long term. So when they come and ask for your subscriber data, don't give it up. Delete it if you have to. Burn it if you have to. Don't give it to them. Don't give them your subscriber data. By the way, there's a new company out. If you lose your computer is stolen, or you lose all your data, it's no problem whatsoever. All you have to do is contact the NSA, and they'll give you a free copy of your backup. No, actually, wait a minute. It's not free. It is $99 for Democrats, and it's $199 for Republicans. And don't bother trying to fool them, because they already know. Okay? $99, you liberals, full recovery of all your data from NSA. It's a new feature. You know, come on, it's a full-service government. of course, the extreme resolve of fighting is to shut down entirely and destroy everything. Take an axe to it and burn it. But you can always start again because you're smart. Ladar Levison, who's a site owner of a company called LavaBit, that's just what they did. Yep. They were forced to make a difficult decision to become complicit in crimes against the American people or walk away from nearly 10 years of hard work by shutting down LavaBit. After significant soul searching, Mr. Levison says, I have decided to suspend operations. I wish that I could legally share with you the events that led to my decision, but I cannot. The same day, Silent Circle followed suit, shutting down their email service in advance of any government strong-arm tactics. Here's what they said. We see the writing on the wall, and we have decided that it is best for us to shut down Silent Mail now. We have not received subpoenas, warrants, security letters, or anything else by any government, and that is why we are acting now. I realize that this is extreme. Both of those companies can do it because they're small. Google, Facebook, they couldn't possibly shut themselves off rather than cooperate with the government. They're too large. They're public. They have to do what's economically rational, not what's moral. But they can fight. You, an executive in one of those companies, can fight. You'll probably lose, but you need to take the stand. And you might win, especially if you all stick together. It's time we call the government's actions what they really are: commandeering. Commandeering is a practice we're used to in wartime, where commercial ships are taken for military use or production lines are converted to military production. But now, it's happening in peacetime. Vast swaths of the internet are being commandeered to support this surveillance state. If this is happening to your company, do what you can to isolate the actions. Do you have employees with security clearances who can't tell you what they're doing? Cut off all automatic lines of communication with them and make sure that only specific required authorized acts are being taken on behalf of government. Only then Can you look your customers and the public in the face and say that you don't know what is going on, that your company has been commandeered? Journalism professor Jeff Jarvis recently wrote in The Guardian, "Technology companies, now is the moment when you must answer for us, your users. Whether you are collaborators in the U.S. government's efforts to collect it all, our every move on the internet, or whether you, too, are victims of its overreach. That's the difference. So while I'm sure it's cool to have a secret White House meeting with President Obama, I'm talking to you, Google, Apple, AT&T, Verizon, or whoever else was in the room. Resist. Attend the meeting, but fight the secrecy. After all, whose side are you on?" All right, speaking of genetics, because we talked a little bit about genetics in the piece on leukemia and Fukushima, the secret is in the genes. Hidden in the tangled, repetitious folds of DNA structures called centromeres, researchers from Harvard Medical School and the Broad Institute have discovered the hiding place of 20 million base pairs of genetic sequence, finding a home for 10% of the DNA that is thought to be missing from the standard reference map of the human genome. Mathematician Giulio Genovese, a computational biologist in genetics at HMS and the Broad Institute, working in the lab of geneticist Stephen McCarroll, HMS Assistant Professor of Genetics, Director of Genetics for the Stanley Center for Psychiatric Research at the Broad Institute, found a way to use the genomes of Latinos to interpolate the locations of these missing pieces. Their findings will be published in the American Journal of Human Genetics on August 8th. That was just a few days ago. This is really, really fresh, and it's exciting. In Nature, polymerase, the molecular machinery that copies DNA within living cells, can sequence hundreds of millions of base pairs of DNA. The techniques we've developed to sequence DNA in the lab can only do relatively short segments, and we need to stitch those pieces together after the fact, Genovese said. So while we wait for sequencing technology to catch up with nature, we wanted to see if we could use mathematical patterns to find a place for some of the missing pieces. By using the genomes of admixed populations, populations such as Latinos and African Americans that derive ancestry from more than one continent, the team developed a sophisticated mathematical method to help fill in the uncharted regions on the human genome map. The map is a key tool that geneticists rely on to find disease genes and identify the functional genetic variations at the core of human diversity. Skin color, hair color, eye color, you know, those kinds of things. Height, weight, those kinds of things. The unmapped DNA also sometimes resembles known mapped genes, which can interfere in attempts to study similar sequences. Best known as the molecular hinges that help chromosomes divide, centromeres have been widely considered structural elements that were unlikely to harbor protein-coding genes, the researcher said. For this reason, they're finding that nearly half of the unmapped sequences contained in available genomic reference libraries, including many protein-coding genes, were actually located in the centromeres. And this was completely unexpected. They didn't look there because they thought that was the sole purpose of the centromeres. They were wrong. Science is so funny about that. I wonder how many times the religious high priests of science said, No, you're not looking in the centromeres for those genes. They're not there. Well, they were. Surprisingly, the study also found that the genomes of Latino individuals are more uniquely powerful resource for assembling maps of the human genome. The study searched 242 Latino genomes from the 1,000 genomes Project Phase 1 for DNA sequences that have not yet been located on the reference human genome map. Throughout the history of genomic research, different populations have given unique gifts to genetic inquiry because of the history or structure of that population, such as Semitics, you know, Jewish, Hebrews, or Jewish people, black people, Nordic people, believe it or not, have pretty pure genetic structure. Hold on a moment. Good orange juice. So when you find these multi-continental people, then you can find the pieces that come from the parent continents, and then you can see how they blend together. So when you have Semitic races and Indian races that blend together to make Latinos, especially South American Latinos, because we know that some 2,300 years B.C., some of those tribes migrated to that area and began to intermingle with the people. And then it happened again in 600 B.C., and then probably again in 500 A.D. So you see a lot of infusing of that kind of material. That's why when you look at a Tibetan from Tibet and you look at an American Indian from America, a Native American, you see tremendous similarities. The same skin color, the same lack of facial hair, the same noses, the same cheek structure. You see great similarities. It's because of this, you know, migration and pure injection of whole gene classes into other pure gene classes. Now, the power of the Latino genome for Genovese's approach came from the contribution of the African ancestors that many Latino individuals have. Because of their long history of human evolution on the continent, the African genome is rich in genetic diversity. Other human populations evolved from subsets of that diverse population. As small groups migrated around the globe just a few tens of thousands of years ago, sometimes, however, the lack of diversity in a population can be an asset for researchers. Because you don't have this foreign material. You, sort of like a pure breed of any animal, you end up with a fairly understandable genetic code. Sometimes the lack of diversity does turn out to be an asset, and sometimes it does not. There are island populations, for example, that have allowed the discovery of recessive mutations that are rare in most of the world, but happen to be more common on a given island. Because, you know, a recessive gene, it takes two recessive genes together in order for that to be expressed. In other words, the female and the male have to have the recessive gene in order for it to be expressed in the offspring. Otherwise, the dominant gene overrides the recessive gene, and you don't see the recessive gene expressed. Latino populations have a relatively distinctive gift to give, having some recent African ancestry, but just a little, can yield especially powerful information about what the structure of the human genome is in all populations. When chromosomes recombine with each other in each generation, they do so in relatively large segments or chunks. You can actually watch it with a microscope. In the genomes of Latinos, many of whom trace ancestry to European, Native American, and African populations, the mixed European, Native American, and African sequences form a mosaic of large segments. Imagined as separate colors, an admixed genome would look like a mosaic with large red, green, and blue tiles rather than a video screen with tiny mixed color pixels. Genovese developed an algorithm that could be used could use a missing sequence's proximity to known genetic markers to pinpoint where on the chromosome the missing pieces fit. It's a technique first reported in a related paper in February, which localized a smaller sample of genes. Knowing where these things are physically allows scientists to be able to kind of snip them out and study them and even recombine them or or fix things. And I'm not saying that they would engineer their own human being, but I wouldn't put it past them. We're very, very close to being able to do that. Transhumanists, and we've had a couple of interviews on X Squared Radio, and we're going to pursue some more as this becomes more evident, because we have a lot of human-animal interaction, that is to say, with mice and with pigs and rabbits and things like that. We're mixing human DNA with those DNA to create things, to study blood and to study different organs and effects of different drugs on animals instead of humans. It's a common thing. Normally, we don't take the human-animal zygotes to full term and actually create a pup, especially one that can reproduce. But I'm not saying that it isn't done at all. Believe me, there's some pretty liberal things going on out there in the scientific field, unpublished. This technique works best, by the way, when individuals have some African DNA, because the diversity among African genomes provides a high number of genetic markers. But Genovese discovered that this technique is most powerful when individuals have only a little African ancestry, because this genetic signal is then most localized to a smaller number of regions. It's easier to stain for, and it's easier to map. Until this work, scientists have tended to assume that mapping the remaining patches of terra incognita in the human genome would require future improvements in sequencing technology. But now they are making some serious headway, especially with these mathematical models. The millions of base pairs of sequence that Genovese and McCarroll's team have located will be added to the next release of the reference human genome assembly. And it's, let's just call it the Google Maps of the human genome. Other people will be able to search it and use it and carry on with their experiments, having this base knowledge to go by. Yes, they will be using it for transhumanism. They will be using it to try to cure diseases. They may be using it to, create a super soldier, or to extend life, to discover the secret to turning the aging off in the human. Hopefully, if they end up doing that, they also turn off the fertility so that these people don't have generations of babies, and thus overpopulating the planet. That's one of the things that kind of keeps us in check, is that we only live about 80 years and then we're gone. And less than that if we abuse our bodies. You know, smoking and drinking and plenty of red meat, not good for you. So you need to exercise and eat right and keep your body weight down. Don't get overweight. And I know a lot of people that do this. You know, my good friend Nick Begich, the last time I saw him in Holland, my gosh, he looked 10 years younger than I saw him just like 4 years ago, and we communicate on a fairly regular basis. He's getting younger. His skin looks great. His hair looks great. He looks amazing. I'm just blown away by how good he looks, and several people that I know are doing the same thing. I went to my physician, and he said, "You are where I was when I was 42. So that's good. That's good. That's what we want to do. We want to take care of one another, and we want to continue to grow. As a race, as a people, we want to learn how to live with one another in peace. And I don't mean oppression. I don't mean tyranny. I mean to live in peace with one another and to help each other reach our fullest potential. I think it's, you know, the way to go. I just think it's powerful and makes us into the eternal beings that we have always been. And the fact that for some reason in mortality we forget who we were, we forget who we are, and we get all trapped up in this race for physical things and toys and power and money, it's so foreign. I have a hard time understanding it. Yes, we are trying to build an electric car company. But as a side effect, there will be, billions and even tens of billions of dollars made. But we already have a list of charitable operations that we'll be fully about. to try to make the planet a better place. And if we can relieve at least part of the transportation industry from the use of petroleum as a method of fuel, then we've done our job. That's our goal. That's our mission statement, is to displace as many gasoline-burning engines as possible in the light delivery market. You want to learn more about it, go visit us at visionmotorcars.com. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with Hour 3. I want to talk about economics. Oh, you're going to love this. You are going to love this. This economic section in Hour 3 is tremendous. We'll see you after the break.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We are live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 57 degrees and clear. It is a magnificent night for this time of year. So glad that you could be here with us. Our phone number, if you want to be part of the program, is 888-429-5471, toll-free anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, it is a simple process. You can get to a cell phone tower. You can reach us at 530-413-9537. And don't forget about that conference line. It's really an amazing way to listen to BBS Radio and X Squared Radio, because you can call it up on your phone and you can listen to the program. You can go about your business or whatever you're doing, working on your favorite project or walking or riding a bike or whatever, and you can listen. It's 805-399-1000. You can put it on speed dial, and it's real easy. If you have an iPhone or other phones, you can put in 805-399-1000 and then comma, comma, or pause, pause, and then 769-608-pound, 769-608-pound, and then save it. And next time you want to listen, just hit the speed dial, and the pause, pause will allow the little request for your passcode to be read, and then it will put in that passcode number, and you're in. Oftentimes we look at our situation in life and we think that it is hopeless. It is not. sometimes we make mistakes, things that we want to keep to ourselves, or relationships that we have with people. We want to preserve them and we want to keep them safe. And we make mistakes from time to time. Sometimes we say things we regret. Sometimes things are found out about us that our spouse or our mate or our soulmate or our girlfriend or boyfriend, or no matter what your sexual orientation is, are discovered that hurt that relationship. I'm asking you, as host of this program and as fellow human on this planet in this generation, to forgive one another. Forgive yourself, especially if you loved a little too hard. If you've done something else, you physically harmed someone or you violated someone in some way, forgive yourself. Ask for forgiveness from the person whom you have wronged, and go and sin no more. It is the way we grow as a people. You can leave any habit behind in 30 days. Any habit. There are lots and lots of training programs out there for you to do it. And if you can't do it on your own, there are organizations that make a living helping you to do it. But if it's something simple, if it's an interpersonal relationship, if you read a text of someone that hurt you, or you found out something about somebody you didn't like, I'm asking you to forgive. Forgive and move on and love one another. You know, sometimes we strive for interpersonal relations, especially when we're young. We're designed that way, you know, the passion that's inside of us, the quickening of the heartbeat, the heightening of the blood pressure, the spreading of the pheromones. I mean, come on, the whole erection of human copulation is based upon this. It is the survival of the race. It's instinctive. As humans, we try to control those urges. We limit them to one or two or anyway, a small number of individuals with whom we have this activity. And that is what creates society. It creates families. It creates neighborhoods and states and nations. And when that process breaks down, that is to say, when we succumb to the animal urges to multiply, and we do not curb that activity with self-restraint, with prudence and guidance and some kind of honor, then the family begins to break down. And when the family breaks down, the community breaks down. When the community breaks down, the city and the state break down. And we're seeing the result of that. And there are different forces that work in different generations. Some of them are disease, some of them are war. You know, all the men are called up and off they go, and you have a bunch of widows and single women, and all the good men are taken up or are dead. Believe me, I come from a line of Agnews. I know exactly what you're talking about. Because Agnews were the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway, okay? We fought in Scotland. And unfortunately for history, or at least for genetics, we were usually the second to the last man standing. That means that anytime you go to the phone book and look up Agnews, there aren't very many. Unless, of course, you're in the hometown of Stranraer, Scotland, on the west coast. There are lots of Agnews there. Agnew Bay and Agnew Crescent and Agnew Park. Yes, they're all there. I've been there. Wonderful group of Agnews they are. But here in the United States and elsewhere in the world, Agnews are a small clan because, well, we took to the sword a little too often, even though our motto is counsel before violence. But it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes it's by choice. And sometimes it's by design. A government steps in and says to a group of women or to a racial group of women, you do not need a man at home anymore. In fact, if you have a man at home, I'm not going to give you this money. And so in a couple of generations, and believe me, these kinds of socio-economic engineering efforts have their effect. The man was eliminated from the family unit, the African-American family unit, and the family collapsed. Only about 12% of African-American families have a father and a mother at home. And we know from interviewing death row inmates, these are bad men. These are men that killed multiple times on purpose. 98% of them did not have a father at home. I can tell you as a former scoutmaster for 6 years, I had 18 boys. Only 4 of them had dads at home. And it's a good program, you know. A scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. What kind of qualities would you want in a man other than that? All those boys grew up to be fine young men because of those 6 years with a substitute dad. So if you have the opportunity to have this interpersonal relationship with someone and you're fertile and you should happen to copulate with a member of the opposite sex and a pregnancy results, you better be doing it on purpose. You better be doing it to form that empire. Because if you form that child and you walk away, you are not a human. Oh, you're mortal. But you're an animal. And I'm asking you to step up to the plate, you young men out there, and you be human. When you have sex with a woman, make sure you mean it. That's all I'm saying. It's a powerful message. There might only be 6 of you that it applies to that listen to this program, but you can tell 6 more, and it'll make a difference. All right. In this hour, we have a news brief, and it's important. It has to do with economics. You guys want to stay ahead of the curve. I have received mail from some of our listeners that they have taken the advice that I have said, and I have this to say, bravo. They sold their 401k, they cashed it in, paid the 10% hit, cashed it in. Now, most of their money is held in a credit union. These are outside the banker world, okay? Credit unions are owned by those who are members of that credit union. The money is not extracted and taken to some foreign bank in a foreign country and then derived into future generations. You know, when you talk about derivatives, people's eyes roll back in their head. Oh, what's a derivative? Think of it like this. They are deriving value from future generations. Yes, they take all the future payments on a lease, all the future payments on a bond or a loan, and they derive value from those future payments, a future value. It's called the FV. If you have a HP 12C, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It's a handheld financial calculator. That future value is being derived into present money. In other words, they're spending money that the next generation and the next generation will earn. Yeah, all the guys at the poker table are broke. And so what they did is they borrowed money from the next generation of poker players and their kids. And that's what they're spending at the table right now. And that's why they're broke and you're broke and the nation's broke and the world is broke. In this news brief, we'll discuss the latest news on the economic collapse. Oh, yeah. Make no mistake about it. It isn't recovering. We look to see if things are really that different. The central bank will not stop at just confiscating your wealth. Or your kids, or your grandkids. And believe me, they're in that generation now. They also want your life. They want to enslave the people of the world. Okay? CNBC's Fast Money O'Rourke added that flows of capital into U.S. stocks were overwhelmingly into exchange-traded funds. I think that's blind buying. It's just an asset allocation, he said. It's not people buying stocks because they think they're cheap or they're good values. It's their brokers. It's their mutual funds. It's people just wanting to have exposure in the markets. And we're at an all-time high. It's a big risk. And now you're having a big rise in interest rates. You know what's going to happen. You know exactly what's going to happen, especially if you listen to this program. Experts say 2013 is on pace to see the highest number of U.S. expatriations ever. Let me explain to you what that is. This is the number of U.S. taxpayers renouncing citizenship or permanent resident status. It surged to a record high in the second quarter as new laws aimed at cracking down on overseas assets increased the cost of complying and the risk of a taxpayer misstep. Because if you miss a step, if you forget to file, if you forget to include something, oh, the penalties are unbelievable. A total of 1,130 names appeared on the latest list of renunciations from the Internal Revenue Service, according to Andrew Mitchell, a tax lawyer in Centerbrook, Connecticut, who tracks the data. That is far above the previous high of 679 set in the first quarter and more than were reported in all of 2012. The trend is remarkable. The trend is changing everything. There are lags in reporting renunciations. It might mean that many who appeared on the current list made the move months earlier, but nevertheless, the trend is alarming. Taxpayers who renounce can be subject to an exit tax. In other words, we're going to take one more crack at you before you're no longer a taxpayer of this country. I think Spain is doomed to collapse. That's just my opinion. The question on my mind is when will it collapse? Spain's exposure to Portuguese sovereign debt and unrealized losses on real estate loans, and, of course, a mass exodus of Spain's wealthy, are several reasons that a collapse is absolutely inevitable. The Spanish banking system also passed a so-called stress test in 2012. But sovereign government bonds are also not included in the evaluation. It is a recipe for disaster, I can tell you right now. I think that what's happening is these taxpayers and companies are actually thinking that they can disappear to places like Ireland or Singapore or Dubai, and that they won't have to pay taxes anymore. It's strange to see. You know, taxpayers aren't required to explain the move, but experts said the rise is likely due to tougher laws and also better enforcement. You'll notice now that when you electronically file your taxes, H&R Block or whatever, you get the answer back literally within hours, at the most days. How do you think they go through all of those returns, all those easy 1040s, all those 1040s? How do you think they go through that? They go through it because it's all computerized. You have a history in there. As long as there is no radical change in what you do or how much you make or where you are, then all is well. Things will recover quickly. You won't get audited. But if something changes, they're going to crack down on you.
Now, the IRS declines comment on this, but I can tell you from not personal experience, but other experience, that this is true. So the U.S. launched a new tax crackdown after the terrorist attack in 2001, and they ratcheted it up after 2009 and made evidence that several organizations, foreign institutions, help U.S. taxpayers hide their assets. Some taxpayers have applied for IRS limited amnesty programs in which they pay stiff penalties for past noncompliance but avoid prosecution. That's a quick, easy way for the IRS to, cut their costs. They get a one lump sum payment. They don't have to sue people. They frighten them into compliance, and so they don't have to worry about them again. In addition, a law enacted in 2010, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, or its acronym is FATCA, requires foreign financial institutions to certify they aren't hiding U.S. taxpayer assets, which lawyers say is leading some to reject U.S. customers. They don't want to be hunted. They don't want to be audited. Taxpayer penalties for failing to report assets can be severe. 50% of an account balance for each year. The web of rules is overly burdensome, a former federal prosecutor said, who led the 2009 UBS case, which resulted in the banks agreeing to a $780 million settlement with the IRS. He is now a lawyer in private sector in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He says you basically find yourself in this continuous nightmare. I'm wondering if the conference line is working. I'm getting messages from people that the 805-399-1000, 768, oh, I got it wrong. It's 769-608 pound. Oh. Okay, let me take care of that. 769-6. I'm so bad at texting. You just have to forgive me. 608. There we go. All right. Now, that guy's in. All right. I want to cover this in some detail, but a lot of you are not affected by this. The point is that people are becoming disheartened with being an American because it's becoming oppressive. It's becoming invasive. And it is getting worse on several different levels. I want to talk about a speech that Obama made. It's actually a tale of two speeches, and both are from the same man, from President Barack Obama. One speech could have been billed as a ballad to the Constitution, a proclamation of American values, a repudiation of the lawless behavior of the last administration, the Bush administration, the one that got all the blame. And another speech announcing a radical new claim of presidential power that is not afforded by the Constitution and that has never been attempted in American history, even by George Bush and Dick Cheney. Remarkably, President Obama made both speeches at the same time. Yeah, and with all in one speech, standing inside the National Archives in front of the actual original Constitution, President Obama delivered a blistering critique of the Bush administration in which he called their legacy literally a mess. Here's what he said. Our government made a series of hasty decisions, poorly planned, haphazard approach. Too often we set those principles aside as luxuries that we could no longer afford. Our government made decisions based on fear rather than foresight. The decisions that were made over the last 8 years established an ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism that was neither effective nor sustainable. Those are the president's words. I'm shocked. An ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism that was neither effective nor sustainable? Yow! That's a right hook. Then, just moments later, he announced his own ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism. President Obama proposed something new, something called prolonged detention. Doesn't that sound bad? I mean, right? Prolonged detention. Did you ever see the movie Minority Report? You remember the film with Tom Cruise, Morgan Freeman? It was based on a Philip K. Dick short story. It came out in 2002. I think most of you have seen it. It was a good movie, really good special effects. Anyway, Tom Cruise played a police officer in something called the Department of Pre-Crime. Pre-crime is where people are arrested and incarcerated to prevent crimes they have not yet committed, but they have been foreseen by an oracle that they are going to commit. Here's the line. Tom Cruise is making his arrest in the very beginning of the movie. He says, "Mr. Marks, I am mandated by the District of Columbia Pre-Crime Division. I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks. It's going to take place today, April 22nd, at 0800 hours and 4 minutes. And as they're handcuffing him and getting ready to put him on deep ice, he says, "No, no, I didn't do anything." That's right. He didn't do anything, but he was going to. Future murder. Creepy, right? Putting somebody in jail, not for what they have done, but for what they're very sure they're going to do. Here's Obama again. "There may be a number of people who cannot be prosecuted for past crimes, in some cases because evidence may be tainted, but who nonetheless pose a threat to the security of the United States. Excuse me, we're not prosecuting them for past crimes, but we need to keep them in prison because of our expectation of their future crimes. Am I to understand that that way?" Mr. Obama again. "Al-Qaeda terrorists and their affiliates are at war with the United States, and those that we capture, like other prisoners of war, must be prevented from attacking us again." I'm sorry, prevented? We will incarcerate people preventively? Preventive incarceration. That's what we should call it. Indefinite detention without trial. That's what it is. That's what President Obama proposed in his speech, if you strip away the euphemisms. One civil liberties advocate told the New York Times today, and I quote, "We've known this was on the horizon for many years, but we were able to hold it off with George Bush. The idea that we might find ourselves fighting with the Obama administration over these powers is really stunning." And it is stunning, particularly to hear President Obama claim the power to keep people in prison indefinitely with no charges against them, no conviction, no sentence, just imprisonment. It's particularly stunning to hear him make that claim in the middle of a speech that was all about the rule of law. Here's Mr. Obama again. "But we must do so with an abiding confidence in the rule of law. Our government was defending positions that undermine the rule of law to ensure that they are in line with the rule of law." How can a president speak the kind of poetry that President Obama does about the rule of law, the call for the power to indefinitely preventively imprison people because they might commit crimes in the future? How can those two things coexist in the same man, even in the same speech? Well, that brings us to the self-consciously awkward, embarrassing part of this speech. After condemning the Bush administration for what he calls their ad hoc legal strategy for trying to make things seem legal that patently weren't, this is what President Obama proposed. Listen closely. "My administration has begun to reshape the standards that apply to ensure that they are in line with the rule of law. We must have clear, defensible, and lawful standards for those who fall into this category. We must have a thorough process of periodic review so that any prolonged detention is carefully evaluated and justified. Our goal is to construct a legitimate legal framework for the remaining Guantanamo detainees that cannot be transferred. Our goal is not to avoid a legal, legitimate framework. In our constitutional system, prolonged detention should not be the decision of any one man. If and when we determine that the United States must hold individuals to keep them from carrying out an act of war, we will do so within a system that involves judicial and congressional oversight. And so going forward, my administration will work with Congress to develop an appropriate legal regime so that our efforts are consistent with our values and our Constitution. I'm sorry, you will construct a legal regime to make indefinite detention legal. You will. What did he say? Develop an appropriate legal regime so you can construct a whole new system outside the courts, even outside the military commissions, so that you can indefinitely imprison people without charges, and you'll build that system from scratch. What's that somebody said about ad hoc legal strategies? Okay, just for context here, in the United Kingdom, where there isn't even a Bill of Rights, there's been a major debate about whether people can be held in preventive detention. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair wanted 3 months, 3 months to be the outer limit on how long anyone could be held. And there was a big political fight about it. And so Parliament actually ended up limiting that power to 28 days. 28 days. It's still the longest period of preventive detention that's allowed under any law and any comparable democracy anywhere in the world. How long would President Obama's proposed preventative indefinite detention last? Well, he's not saying yet. But here's how he defines the threat that he says makes indefinite detention necessary. Mr. Obama. Right now, in distant training camps and in crowded cities, there are people plotting to take American lives. That will be the case a year from now, 5 years from now, and in all probability, 10 years from now. 10 years from now. So you could be arrested today and locked up without a trial, without being convicted, without being sentenced to say anything. And you could serve 10 years until the threat of your future criminal behavior passes. Prolonged detention, he's calling it. It's a beautiful speech from President Obama, with patriotic, moving, even poetic language about the rule of law and the Constitution, and one of the most radical proposals for defying that Constitution that we have ever heard made to the American people. I quoted it exactly. So if this prolonged detention was to take place, where would you go? Pray tell, what would you do? Well, until now, I have not really examined the idea that these FEMA camps exist. I just, listen to the evidence. I've seen several reports from people. Some have good sources, including video from the alleged locations. I don't know. But I do know that the tactics that are being used are chilling. Now, I'm going to play you a piece of tape here, a piece of tape. Boy, I'm showing my age. Some digital information recorded from Fox News. Now, one of my favorite people, Judge Napolitano, is queried by Shepard Smith. And I want you to listen closely, because this is one of the few times, the only other time I heard Shep do this was during the Katrina disaster, a hurricane. He was down there on an overpass in Mississippi, and he was literally yelling at the top of his lungs to get some support down there for the people. It's the only other time I've seen Shep lose it. I want you to listen closely because this is really something. Here we go.
U.S. government now laying out its legal argument for killing American citizens overseas without a trial. But what about targeting people on U.S. soil? Can they now kill American citizens inside the country? The head of the FBI, when asked about that on Capitol Hill yesterday, stumbled around on this.
Does that only apply to U.S. citizen that's overseas, or does that apply to U.S. citizen that's here as well?
I'd have to go back. I'm not certain whether that was addressed or not.
So that we have clarity here, he is not certain whether it was addressed, whether our government can kill our own people inside our own country. This really needs to be addressed. We can't just answer this question. No, the government doesn't kill our own people. We have a process for this. It's called the justice system. You file charges, you lock them up, you try them before a jury of their peers, and then that's how they don't kill our own people. Judge, the question is, can they kill our own citizens inside our own country?
Well, the answer,
this is a question we have to ask.
It's not a question that we should have to ask, and it's not a question that he should have evaded answering. I think he probably knows that the answer is no, but he doesn't want to frustrate his bosses who articulated just 2 days earlier that the answer is yes, because at a speech on Tuesday at Northwestern University Law School, the Attorney General of the United States manifested extraordinary ignorance of the Constitution of the United States and suggested the president can kill anybody he wants outside the United States if that person is dangerous, if that person has committed crimes, and if it's impractical to arrest that person. Not in the opinion of a jury, but in the opinion of the president and some secret advisors. The Constitution says to the contrary. The Constitution says if the government wants your life or your liberty or your property, it has to articulate to a jury what law you have violated and prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt to that jury. It's called due process. Without due process, the government could take anything it wanted and kill anybody it wanted. And Attorney General Holder ought to know that. I suggest that Bob Mueller does. And the reason he evaded that answer is because he wants to keep his job.
Well, you heard what Eric Holder said. He said there is due process, but there is not due juris something or other.
Judicial process.
Not judicial process.
What the Attorney General said, let me make his argument. His argument is that there is a substituted form of due process. That if the president and his advisors carefully consider the danger of a human being and conclude that that human being needs to be stopped before that person causes any more danger, then the president can kill him. That's their argument. There is no case law that stands for that. There is no statute that authorizes it. And it directly defies the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
Sounds like a crime against humanity. What's the difference between that and what Bashar al-Assad is doing to his own people? What is the difference?
Nothing. What's the difference between killing somebody, an American with a drone in Yemen and killing an American with a drone in Peoria? Nothing.
Right.
Same argument that Eric Holder made at the Northwestern Law School on Tuesday about al-Awlaki in Yemen could be made about somebody in Peoria tomorrow.
You make an illegal lane change in Hollywood on the 101 freeway and a drone will just shoot you out of the sky and throw you, you know, bury you.
Well, I don't know that it's going to
happen. I don't know either, but who'd have thought we'd ever get to hear?
Who would have thought that we'd even be having a conversation like this? That's
right. Who would have thought we were to even be having a conversation like this? But we are. We are having this conversation. And now we're talking about these FEMA camps. And there's been a lot of chatter out there about them. There's been some pretty convincing pictures. Until now, I really didn't pay much attention to it. I've never seen one for myself. I always think there's a reasonable explanation for these facilities to be erected. Sometimes they're industrial parks. Sometimes, you know, there are activities going on inside there that need to be top secret. However, there is a military document that is real. It is called the Restricted U.S. Army Internment and Resettlement Operations Manual, FM3-39.40, Internment and Resettlement Operations. It's 326 pages long. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing because we don't have that much time, but I'm going to read some excerpts from it. Because this explains, it's sort of like a work procedure. It explains how to handle detainees. Now, all you really have to do, for those of you that have flown recently, I have and some of my very close friends have, and they have become kind of routine now. We walk up, we take our shoes off, our belt off, our jacket off, our hat off, empty our pockets, put our computer, laptop into a separate tub, put everything else in another tub that's kind of loose, including our toiletries. We run it through an X-grader. We stand there with our hands over our head, and we get a body scan. And if something shows up abnormally, then they frisk us. It's called illegal search and seizure. Because if they find anything in that bag, you know, a fingernail file or a pair of scissors, they're going to toss it in the trash. Why? Well, because it's the weapon that's dangerous, not you. Everyone that comes in there is assumed to be dangerous. And so we're going to take anything away from them that would allow them to be dangerous inside an airplane. You remember the good old days? And they're really not that long ago, really not, when you could just get to the airport, walk up to the gate with your family, kiss everybody, hug everybody, and walk onto the airplane. You remember those days? Yes, we had a hijacking every now and then. It would be hijacked to Cuba or wherever. But we didn't change our lifestyles. You know, we had Lockerbie. We had TWA Flight 800. But we didn't change our lifestyles. And then 2001, September 11th, we had an event that changed our lifestyles. It allowed government to literally search every one of us before we get into that airport system. Still, people get by with strange stuff. I remember a pocket knife I had in my bag for years, and then it was finally discovered by a TSA agent. I can't tell you how many times and how many countries that bag was X-rayed. And yet it finally showed up. Just interesting. So here's the work procedure. It's called the detainee processing technique. Because you realize that there's only going to be a few guards, just like there are at the airport. There's 8 or 10, you know, telling you what you got to do. You got to take your toiletries out. You have to take your belt off. You have to take your shoes off, blah, blah, blah. Those of us that have been through it thousands of times or hundreds of times or dozens of times, we know the routine. So we just put our head down and we say, yeah, whatever it takes to keep us safe, right? But we've gotten used to it. And so those 8 or 10 people can process thousands and thousands of people because we comply. But when you're detaining people, when you're going in and you're grabbing neighborhoods of people, or you're gathering people that are migrating on a freeway, they're walking in the emergency lane from one city to another, and you gather them up in mass, they're not going to be cooperative. They're not going to put their heads down. And so here's what the manual says, Section 4, Paragraph 33. Section 33. Here we go. Upon capture, soldiers must process detainees using the search, silence, segregate, speed, safeguard, and tag technique. In parentheses, they call it the 5 S's and T. That's how you write a work procedure. You create something that becomes automatic for these soldiers. They know what to do. They know how to process. Anything out of the ordinary of that, and you deal with it swiftly, severely. Here we go. This technique provides a structure to guide soldiers in conducting detainee operations until they transfer custody of detainees to another authority or location. Complete the 5 S's and T technique as follows. Search. Neutralize a detainee and confiscate weapons, personal items, and items of potential intelligence and or evidentiary value. Silence. Prevent detainees from communicating with one another or making audible clamor, such as chanting, singing, praying. Silence uncooperative detainees by muffling them with a soft, clean cloth tied around their mouths and fastened at the back of their heads. Do not use duct tape or other adhesives. Place a cloth or either objects inside the mouth or apply physical force to silence detainees. I'm reading straight from the manual. Segregate. segregate detainees according to policy and SOPs. Those are standard operating procedures. Segregate requirements differ from operation to operation. The ability to segregate detainees may be limited by the availability of manpower and resources at the point of containment. At a minimum, try to segregate detainees by grade, gender, age, keeping adults from juveniles and small children with mothers, and security risk. MI and military, that's military intelligence, and military police personnel can provide additional guidance and support in determining the appropriate segregation criteria. The next term, speed. Quickly move the detainees from the continuing risks associated with other combatants or sympathizers who may still be in the area of capture. If there are more detainees than the soldiers can control, call for additional support. Search the detainees and hold them in place until reinforcements arrive. Safeguard. Protect detainees and ensure the custody and integrity of all. Confiscate confiscated items. Soldiers must safeguard detainees from combat risk, harm caused by other detainees, and improper treatment or care. Report all injuries. Correct and report violations of U.S. military policy that occur while safeguarding detainees. Tag. Ensure that each detainee is tagged using DD Form 2745. Confiscated equipment, personal items, and evidence will be linked to the detainee using the DD Form 2745. Where a DA Form 4137 is used to document a confiscated items, it will be linked to the detainee by annotating the DT Form 2745. And you got it. Now, as every day passes, it becomes clearer that our once free nation is quickly turning down the path of a totalitarian police state. This trend is also reflected in the recent United States Army job posting for internment resettlement specialists. Oh yeah, they posted the job. While this might sound tame and harmless to some, upon reading the job description, a troubling picture emerges. The internment resettlement specialist, or IR specialist for short, is not only tasked with handling the custody and control of individuals designated as enemy prisoners of war, but also of so-called civilian internees. These are called CIs. This is a classic example of Orwellian language. You're not an American citizen being indefinitely imprisoned by a military in a military prison. Instead, you're a CI. In this article, we discover exactly what civilian internee is, what few rights are afforded to them, and just how oppressed a civilian internee actually is, according to the military's own document on the subject. It is, in a word, chilling. Chapter 6 of the document entitled Administration and Operation of CI Internment Facilities. Beginning on page 23 of the PDF document, it delves into some of these issues. Beginning with section 6-3, we learn that civilian internees have no real right to property under this military rule. While they pretend to give the detainee property rights, it is clear that they can strip you of your belongings for any reason. And it is happening in a couple of counties, and this has just recently been in the news in the last couple days. If you're traveling and you happen to get pulled over by law enforcement, you can be searched and your vehicle can be searched. Now, you may think, I have nothing to hide. I am on vacation with my family. I am heading to college. I'm going to go buy a car. I'm going to go make a down payment on a house. You might be carrying cash with you. Well, I can tell you right now that if you're carrying more than about $100, it can be confiscated by the police. That's right. If you're on vacation and you're not carrying traveler's checks with you, let's say you're carrying $3,000 in cash, that's nothing. I have friends that carry $20,000 in cash with them because they just like to. They like the power it affords them. They like the ability, the freedom to whip out cash and pay for things if they want to, anonymously if they want to. The police can confiscate the cash. That's right, because you are immediately suspected of intending to conduct an illegal transaction. That's right. You are suspected of intending to conduct an illegal transaction. In other words, if you have $5,000 in cash on you and you're just hanging out, you're just driving around, you're at a concert, or you're at a hotel, you're on vacation, you're at a resort, they can take the cash from you because they're afraid you're a drug dealer. They're afraid you're a terrorist. You're moving cash around. They can't trace it. They can't track it. A debit card, that's different. But if you're carrying cash, the police will steal it from you, and you will never get it back, ever. It's already happening. Subsection B states, the personal effects that detainees are allowed to retain but are taken from them temporarily for intelligence purposes will be receipted for and returned as soon as practical. Essentially, they can claim your belongings are needed for intelligence purposes and hold them until it's deemed practical to return them. When would that be? It's anyone's guess. Section 6-4 goes over the so-called internee committee, which is a 2-3-person committee which is empowered to represent the camp to the protecting powers. International Committee of the Red Cross or other authorized relief or aid organization and U.S. military authorities. Well, once again, the military is able to determine what exactly you can do, and this language clearly allows the military to deny access to any outside relief or aid organization by saying that they're simply not authorized. Under subsection C, each member of the internee committee will be approved by the camp commander prior to assumption of duty. If the camp commander refuses to approve or dismiss an elected or dismisses an elected member, a notice to that effect with reasons for refusal or dismissal will be forwarded through the channels to the branch Prisoner of War Information Center. So, you get the idea. Even if the FEMA camps do not exist, or if they do, the procedures for handling it do exist. And it has been done before. In World War II, Japanese citizens or visitors to the United States were interned during the war. They were seen as sympathizers for the Japanese. They didn't do it to German Americans. They didn't do it to Polish Americans. They didn't do it to Chinese Americans. They didn't do it to Arab Americans, only to Japanese. And it was determined to be legal, and they could do it again. So what do we do as American citizens? How do we react to this? Because you realize that there are 300 million of us, and there's only about 275,000 of them. Well, I can tell you that I personally advocate peace and peaceful resolutions. I advocate love, and I advocate a pacifist manner. The way to not participate with this system is to not pay it. In other words, if you want the military, the police actions to stop, try obeying the law, every law, all the speed limit laws, all the traffic laws, all the tax laws, obey everything. When you do, the enforcement agents, the revenuers, the ones that are out there collecting the money, have nobody to collect from. And what happens is it creates an untenable financial burden upon those organizations. No town, no city, no state can afford to have law enforcement officers unless they're receiving some kind of revenue from the people. Unless they're receiving fines, unless they're receiving traffic citation money, and in even a small town, you can take in $25,000 or $30,000 a week. Yeah, true, it's pretty much the same drivers over and over and over again, but try driving the speed limit. Stay within the law. What will happen is it will become financially untenable for them to continue. Now, when it comes to the airports, there's not much you can do. There is no possible way that you can act up and try to get inside the airport space. You're going to be defeated. But when we're not talking about secured space, we're not talking about getting in an airplane and flying from point A to point B. When you're talking about just being on the street, you're talking about being in your community and walking around and, you know, interacting with one another, doing trade with one another. Obey the law. And I would not run out and buy a gun. You think it's a great idea, you get excited about it, you think, oh my gosh, they're going to take away all the guns. Maybe. I doubt it, but it's possible. When you buy that gun, your life is going to change. Unless you put that gun in a box and you put it in your attic and you never look at it again and you never think about it again, your life is going to change. Sooner or later, you're going to want to go plinking with that gun, shoot cans, bottles, targets, and you're going to get good with it, and it's fun. But the real use of a gun is to point at another person and pull the trigger. And I can tell you, when you draw that weapon and you point that little steel barrel at another human being, whether you pull the trigger or not, your life is changed forever. The nightmares never go away, even if you don't pull the trigger. The nightmares never go away. It isn't worth it. I would say look for the good in others and help it to grow. Be excellent to each other, in the words of Bill and Ted. Love each other. Look for the good in each other. Forgive yourself. Forgive others. Because this is the only kind of energy that will make a government like that go away. It will make documents like this gather dust and end up in the history books in the back of the library, and no one will ever look at them. Because there will be no reason to intern you. This is what a citizen of a family, this is what a citizen of a community, this is what a citizen of a state, of a nation should do, is to love and to forgive and to work with one another. And if you hurt someone on purpose or accidentally, seek their forgiveness. And I would say never, ever, ever be afraid to love. Look for it in other people and make yourself open to it, because it is a wonderful, wonderful thing. When you're in love or when you're loving one another, there is no war. There is only peace. There's only patience. There's only long-suffering. There is no violence. There are great dads and great moms and great daughters and great sons. And we strive for great things. We strive for performance in our sports. We strive to lift one another up and to help one another and to feed and clothe one another and eventually to reach for the stars. That's the nation. That's the leadership that will come forward if you have that in your heart. I leave that with you, and I will see you next week. right here on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew.
Yeah.